From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, how a local scientist's approach to autism research differs from most other labs.
We're trying to understand autism in terms of the neural computational deficits that might occur in the disorder, or changes that occur in the disorder.
Later, a local group says we should be able to find a stable funding source for Milwaukee County's parks.
We built parks during the Great Depression. You will go in park after park and find these projects from the WPA and CCC. Those great grandparents of ours and grandparents who built the parks had less money than we do now.
Plus, why excitement over an environmental event in Custer, Wisconsin is building as far away as Milwaukee.
And we'll get to know Anna Lardinoy, the Pfister Hotel's 11th narrator in residence. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Scientists at universities around the country often rely on outside money to fund their research, and this can pose some challenges. Often financial grants and awards come with a lot of strings attached, which can limit how and what scientists research.
But the Shaw Scientist Award is a bit different. Named for the late Milwaukee attorney James Shaw, this award is given to a scientist rather than a specific research project. Ari Rosenberg is one of the 2018 recipients and explains to Lake Effect's Joy Powers what makes this award so unique.
The Shaw Scientist Award is specifically for young investigators, so new scientists at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And every year they award two of these to individuals who they think are doing interesting work that is pushing boundaries in ways that might not necessarily get funding right away.
What exactly did you submit for the award?
So Shaw's a little bit different. I think in part their interest is in funding the scientist so much as funding a specific project. So whereas other grant agencies will request a proposal for a very specific project, the Shaw wants a broader scope about what is the theme of your research, what are specific aspects of projects you're currently working on, and then where do you see it going? So the Shaw is unrestricted in how the funds get used, whereas other grants are highly restricted in the sense that you have to do that project that you proposed.
Now, what does that freedom really mean for you specifically with the kind of work that you're doing?
Yeah, so it kind of bridges computational or theoretical neuroscience and empirical research working with kids with autism or autism spectrum disorders. And this research, we try to understand specific behaviors that where there's demonstrations of some consequence in autism. So one example that we're working on now is contextual learning. So one area that kids with autism often have difficulties is going from one environment to another environment and changing their behaviors to match that environment. So for example, being on a playground versus being in a classroom requires very different behaviors. What we would like to do is understand how the brain processes that contextual information and uses it to guide your behavior.
So by contextual learning, you mean based on the context of the situation, how they learn to behave based on context.
That's right. So how do you look around an environment or a scene and decide how should I behave? So if you're in a classroom, you have your desks, there's a teacher at the front of the room, the teacher tells you to sit down and pay attention, and so you sit down and pay attention, and you start processing the information that the teacher is presenting. In a different environment, say in a playground, there's slides and swings, and kids are running around, and so this is all information that says, okay, well, I can now run around and have fun. on the playground rather than be in a structured environment of a classroom. So how do you guide your behavior based on those events and the things happening around you?
So what kind of studies have you done to date to kind of analyze contextual learning?
Yeah, so we're doing a study now with adolescents with autism and typical development. And we can't, of course, study in an unstructured environment like a playground or in a classroom. This is poses a number of challenges in terms of setting up a rigorous structured study. So what we do is we develop basically computer learning games where we have kids come to the lab for several sessions, and we have them do a task in which we embed information. And we don't tell them about this information that we've embedded, and we look how their behavior is modulated over time. So we look to see, do they start to use the information that we've embedded and in a way that makes sense to improve their performance on a task? This might be, for example, a visual search task where they'll see a cluttered scene and they have to find a particular target, like a specific letter or a shape or something like a Disney character.
Of course, we talked about the kind of freedom that this new money really means for you. Have there been studies that you've wanted to do in the past that you haven't been able to because you weren't able to get the funding that you think you'll be able to do now?
Yeah, so that great question. So my background is in computational neuroscience, and what that basically means is I look at the brain as if it's an engineer that has to solve a specific problem. And so a good example of this is if you have two cameras each taking slightly different pictures of the same scene, how can you take those images and triangulate an object's position to, say, guide a robotic arm to grab the object? And so we look at the brain as the same way that you have, instead of two cameras, you have two eyes, and you have to take in this visual information to triangulate positions of objects to be able to successfully reach and grab them if you want to interact with them. And so our approach to understanding autism is different than many other labs' approaches in the sense that we're trying to understand autism in terms of the neural computational deficits that might occur in the disorder or changes that occur in the disorder. Our experiments are actually motivated by seeing how we can develop neural network models and alter parameters of those models to reproduce specific behaviors. And something that's coming out of this work is that we can actually account for a lot of the behavioral consequences of autism in terms of alterations in a single computation, which basically controls how the activity of different neurons influences each other. And this is a rather interesting idea because it suggests that we might be able to come up with a more unified framework for understanding autism. And this is a bit unusual because typically we look at autism as this highly heterogeneous disorder. And so these kinds of heterogeneities in the disorder have led many people in the field to think that there is no hope of finding a unified framework for understanding the disorder. And so there's some resistance to funding research that will attempt to come up with a unified framework. It's just, it doesn't make intuitive sense to a lot of individuals. But based on our neural network modeling and the behavioral studies that we have completed, we have some strong evidence that suggests that we will be able to come up with a unified framework for understanding the disorder. And so with these kinds of funds, we're actually able to directly test this.
Now, when you say a unified framework, can you kind of describe that for me as someone who is not a neuroscientist and is lost in a bit of the jargon? When you talk about like a unified framework, what does that mean?
Yeah, so when you look at a population of individuals with a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder, so spectrum disorder already starts to give the idea that it's not homogeneous, right? That not everybody that has the disorder has the same behavioral deficits or consequences. So what is the reason for this behavioral heterogeneity? One possibility is that different parts of the brain, different individuals are impacted differently to give rise to the behavioral consequences that get called under the umbrella of autism and autism spectrum disorder. One way of thinking about this is that it's just that different parts of the brain might be impacted differently. Different individuals might be impacted differently. And so there's no single cause or single root that you could use to say, okay, well, this is what causes ASD. From our perspective, we can understand many of the behavioral consequences of the disorder in terms of specific computations that the brain has to perform and changes or alterations in those in the same computation across different brain regions.
So essentially, you're coming up with a kind of formula for the different ways that people might respond. Is that a formula for the disorder, as it were, and how it leads to people responding differently?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So one way of thinking about this, so all the differences across individuals who have autism is a consequence of different formulas being altered in each individual. The formulas that govern how you take in sensory information and produce a behavioral response, that formula is altered in different ways across individuals. Mm. And from our perspective, what we hypothesize is that it's actually the same change happening in different formulas.
Now, this is a big question, I realize, but what is the end goal of this research? What are you hoping to find kind of at the end of it?
Well, one of the really nice things that's coming out of the work that we're doing is that we can actually subgroup individuals with autism into very distinct clusters. And what this means for these individuals is that we have an opportunity to better individualize their treatment plans. So instead of looking at autism as a single homogeneous entity that you have to treat in the same way, which we all know is incorrect, we need to instead individualize treatment plans. So tailor those treatment plans to the individual. But this is problematic because you need to find ways to subgroup in an efficient and meaningful manner. And so one of the main results of our work is developing behavioral and quantitative metrics that allow us to actually do that subgrouping.
So instead of treating a million people a million different ways, you can treat a million people in five, six different kind of ways.
Yeah, our hope is that we can create these kinds of behavioral clusters that will do a better job of individualizing those treatment plans. Moving forward, we're actually hoping to start working with clinicians to take these behavioral metrics to guide treatment plans for their patients.
Ari Rosenberg, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and talking about your work.
Thank you, Joy.
Ari Rosenberg is an assistant professor for the Department of Neuroscience at UW-Madison, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Rosenberg is also one of the recipients of this year's Shaw Scientist Awards, and you can find out more at wuwm.com.
A group of Milwaukee-area people is seeking a dedicated funding source for county parks. We'll hear about their effort when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Earlier this week, we met Guy Smith, the man tapped to be the new director of the Milwaukee County Parks Department. Smith talked about his vision for what is often referred to as the region's Emerald Necklace, the green space that benefits the quality of life here. But Smith and his department face challenges linked to the tight budget environment here.
But a local organization believes it doesn't have to be that way. The group known as Preserve Our Parks has mounted a petition drive calling on lawmakers to establish a dedicated funding source for Milwaukee County Parks. The group is headed by Jim Gooley and includes former County Supervisor Pat Jersic on its board. They are with us in the studio. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can you give us your sense for the state of the parks circa 2018?
Well, it will continue to be a funding crisis. Without getting in the weeds, you have non-mandated and mandated services from the state. For at least the last 10 years, there's been reduction in the shared revenue from the state, which is supposed to pay for mandated services, which has forced the county then to take the funds that support the local programs, parks and buses largely, and use it to pay for the mandates. And the parks are in dire straits because of that. I call it strip mining of public funds.
Well, so does that. What does that mean for people who use the parks? How is this impacting the park going experience?
Right now, it's really not having a great impact because when you do a drive by at a park or in a park, you see it's fairly well maintained. But if you do a closer look and you start looking at some of the facilities in the parks, the infrastructure, you get a better feel for what's really happening. Many of the buildings need paint, windows need glazing, roofs, heating plants, so on and so forth. Some of the athletic fields are atrocious. So we are on the verge of a funding crisis for our parks. Park funding has been dropping over the last 35 years. 35 years ago, the budget was approximately $44 million. Today, it's under $35 million. So you get a feel for that 35 years of reduced funding. And then when you add in inflation over those years, you get a much better feel for what our parks are facing going forward.
This is maybe an obvious-seeming question, but I'm curious to get your take on it. What do the parks bring to people that this should be of concern to them when there are so many funding? I mean, you know, the parks might face a funding crisis, but so do a lot of other things. I mean, you mentioned bus service. There are all sorts of support services for people who, you know, really can't get by otherwise. What is it that the parks bring to the community that you believe the time is now to do something about this?
Well, the parks, I like to point out, the most used athletic facility in the county, including the baseball stadium and the Bucks Arena, by far the most used facility is the Oak Leaf Trail. And of course, the Oak Leaf Trail runs through all the parks, 118 miles surrounded by parks, and that facility is not being cared for properly or taken care of. So you've got the recreation, you've got, that is the main reason millennials enjoy Milwaukee. That's almost number one when they talk about what is the good thing about Milwaukee. But you also have the more intransient things like it's the lungs of Milwaukee, the green space, the trees. It's the sieve for clean water around the lake and the parkways. So you take both of those together, the conservation, the natural resources piece, plus the main recreational facility of the county, and of course the picnic areas, the places where people can actually take family, enjoy recreation and time together. And they do it in the public parks where there's not a great cost to them. So parks are really central, really, to any major city, and we're not properly taking care of them.
Everybody, no matter your wealth, you can enjoy our parks. And if we don't maintain our parks going forward 5, 10, 15 years, that facility is going to be decreasing every year.
So in front of you and in front of me right now is a petition you're circulating. What are you calling for?
We're calling for stable, secure, sustainable funding dedicated for support of parks. It's a pretty straightforward comment there, but the parks do not have stable, secure, or dedicated funding currently, and every single year is a crisis.
Who are you asking for this?
For on behalf of the citizens of Milwaukee County, Preserve Our Parks is the advocacy wing, 501c corporation of really the people who support parks. The park people and the friends groups are all interested in helping and preserving parks, but POP is the advocacy wing. And we're starting what's called an Our Turn Drive. We've used public funds to support building a baseball stadium, which ultimately the profits and the income from that goes to a private franchise. We've now used public funds to build an arena. I'm glad we have the Bucks in town. They're doing a great job building a new arena, but public funds going ultimately to the private profit of that franchise. Now it's time that we use public funds for public parks. And what POP is trying to do is to represent really the people of Milwaukee County. There is a consensus. If you go out, and I've done this for 10 years when I was a county supervisor and continue to do so, if you go out and talk to the people of Milwaukee County, they love their parks. They want their parks taken care of. And yet there's been no real grassroots way of supporting and getting together to petition. This petition drive will hopefully ignite the grassroots and demand that our elected leaders start to listen and find new ways to get stable, secure, dedicated funding for parks.
Which leaders are you asking in this case? Is it the state? Is it the city? Is it the county? Who do you present this to?
Well, first of all, county government is the Milwaukee County local. We have the county executive and the county supervisors. We, first of all, want them to start working together to get on the same page. But they are an arm of state government. County is an arm of state government. So ultimately, the state, they control the formula. And all the supervisors can do is carry out what the state directs. So we do need to get perhaps change in state law. What we want to do is get the grassroots telling our elected leaders, you need to come together and find a way to do stable, secure, dedicated funding.
I point more to the state than the county government. I think county government is kind of backed into a corner financially, and they're doing what they can. But the state is really the policymaker in this regard. And over the last 10 years, Milwaukee County has been sending $400 million more in revenue to the state, and each one of those years getting less back. Not only that, but the state imposed property tax limits on the municipalities as well, and that's putting another crunch on our local funding here. So I would really point the finger more at the state.
Is there a dollar amount you think you have in mind that would stabilize the park system at this stage of the game?
Do we have an actual dollar amount? That would be perhaps hard to say. I can tell you the tax support of parks has been dwindling. Right now, the tax support of Milwaukee County Parks is about $12 million. That number probably needs to double. So if I had to find a number, I would say the tax support itself needs to really go back to the healthy years of the parks. And unfortunately, we've been emphasizing too much the earned revenue. And there's nothing wrong with earned revenue. We have beer gardens and golf courses, et cetera. But the stress has been put on more and more of the earned revenue and less on public support. When we actually need public support if we're going to do the conservation, natural resources preservation.
The petition that you're circulating specifically mentions opposition to parking meters. Why are parking meters, you know, maybe the third rail, to mix a metaphor here?
Well, of course, and there's a recent history around the parking meters that was in last year's budget, but it leads to loss of public access. And, you know, in urban parks, people get access to parks in many ways besides just cars, but they can also access parks through many points of entry. And you will talk to neighborhoods who will say, this would have been a bad idea because all the cars would have done would have been to park all over our city streets and walk into the parks. It was a bad idea for a lot of reasons, but we're against anything that leads to loss of public access. Parking meters did that. And the petition calls for anything else that leads to loss of the public access and enjoyment of public parks.
But you're not opposed to other sorts of revenue like the beer gardens or other kinds of concessions?
Yeah. Public-private partnerships are here to stay. I think the test is, do they cut off public access and enjoyment?
Is there a time frame, a certain momentum you're trying to build with this campaign?
Sure. We're doing town hall meetings right now. We had the first one last week at South Shore. There's one this Thursday, June 14th, Brown Deer Clubhouse. We are doing the town halls to, first of all, inform and then explain the Our Turn drive that POP is undertaking. These petitions get handed out. We are enlisting many, many numbers of friends and those that are interested in parks to start going out. We want to do the fund drive during the summer in time for the county budget. County will start looking at budget. It's already putting the budget together, of course. The county exec will probably start publicizing the budget in August. But at the end of September, the county supervisors will formally receive the budget and then start hearings. And I can tell you it's not a pretty picture already. There's just an increase in benefit costs, for example. We've lost most of the park workers. We've gone from, Jim, what, 700 down to
200? 765 in 1983 to less than 200 today. So that's very alarming.
Yeah, and the just the benefit package, you know, without even giving anyone a pay raise, there's no money being provided for this, no money being provided for increased inflation. So the current formula continues to strangle parks, and this is where we really need to engage not just our local supervisors, who I think are already very supportive of parks, but partners throughout the state. We need to work with other counties who are having some of the same pressures, and ask the state to give us more tools at the local level to start supporting our parks and other needs of the counties. We built parks during the Great Depression. You will go in park after park and find these projects from the WPA and CCC. Those great-grandparents of ours and grandparents who built the parks had less money than we do now. So this is a false narrative that there's no money for public parks. It's just we have been handcuffed.
Pat Jerzyk and Jim Gooley, thank you both so much. Best of luck with your work.
Thank you.
Jim Gooley is a former Parks Department employee who now heads the group Preserve Our Parks. Former County Supervisor Pat Jerzyk is on the board of the group. You'll find a link to more information about their efforts and their Thursday evening public meeting at WUWM.com.
As the Midwest Renewable Energy Association's Energy Fair gets ready to open in the town of Custer, we meet two of the group's Milwaukee-based participants. Lake Effect continues right after this on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. For the 29th consecutive year, organizers are busy hoisting tents and rolling in food trucks to bring a large renewable energy fair to life in rural central Wisconsin. The three-day event is hosted by the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, or MREA, and it draws people from around the country to its headquarters in Custer.
But instead of traveling to Custer, Lake Effect Susan Bentz found excitement over the coming fair on a rooftop in Milwaukee, looking down on the Menominee River Valley. That's where she met Elizabeth Hittman, who serves on MREA's board of directors, and Peter Murphy, MREA's Milwaukee-based solar program manager. Murphy explains why the space they're in is so important.
So we're on the roof of Escuela Verde in the Silver City neighborhood. They're a Milwaukee public charter school. We've got a nice view of Miller Park here. Escuela Verde recently installed solar modules on their roof.
There was also a student from the school directly involved who also worked with you because you helped to train him, right?
Yeah. So MREA, Midwest Renewable Energy Association, does a training program called the Solar Training Academy, and we do this one weekend per month, January, February, March, in Escuela Verde. And as part of this, one of EV's students, Daniel Rodriguez, went through our Solar Training Academy. He got trained up, learned how to install solar panels, and then he got hired on by Current Electric, who installed the solar modules on this school. And so during his spring break, right after he finished his exam for the solar training program, he helped actually install this large solar array on his school, which is just awesome.
So how does this illustrate what MREA is today?
MREA's mission is to promote renewable energy through education and demonstration. And that is exactly what happened here, right? Daniel was educated about solar. He's doing a senior thesis at school about solar, took the professional training, and has now demonstrated solar. And this solar array on their school will be used for years in the future, hopefully, to educate other students about, you know, energy issues, the difference between buying your energy from utility versus creating it yourself, overall just community resilience and self-reliance, energy independence.
So your path to this world, Peter, am I right, this you lived in River, or maybe it was even the pre-River West, was it?
I was in River West.
Yeah,
so I, back in 2013, with the help of Elizabeth Hittman and Amy Hart.
She's here, but you can't see her.
we put together Solar River West, which was a solar group purchasing program. And about, I think, 17 households went solar through the program. Basically, the idea is to get make solar faster, easier, and more affordable by leveraging education and mass, and then volume buying power, an economy of scale to bring down the price of solar. And we started doing these neighborhood by neighborhood around Milwaukee. We did River West, then we did Bayview. We did this neighborhood, Layton Boulevard West. We did Washington Heights. We did the east side. And then we kind of expanded citywide and started working with the suburbs as well. So we did Shorewood, and then we did Wauwatosa. And we do these programs now all over the Midwest. So we've done them in Iowa and Wisconsin, obviously, and Illinois as well.
The first time I talked to you,
it was at the River West Co-op.
I know where it was, but I was trying to think the way you described yourself as a teenager.
Just like a snotty...
Yeah, that's what you said.
Just a snotty punk kid.
Yeah. Interested in what besides being snotty?
Music and the environment, though. I mean, yeah, I mean, just like progressive politics, leftist politics. Majored in poli-sci and English in college, and then I got a master's in nonprofit management at UWM. So this kind of work sort of like percolated for a long time. And before I got hired at the MREA, we were doing those programs, and I was doing it more on like a community organizer level, and now it's more on like a renewable energy advocate level, or coming at it from that perspective.
So let's shift over to Elizabeth Hittman. What was your path to this?
I grew up in Milwaukee. Both my parents were educators, so I feel like that's maybe where I was drawn to the MREA, but really I got inspired the first time I went to the Energy Fair.
You did?
Yeah. I did my undergrad in Stevens Point, and the Energy Fair takes place right outside of Stevens Point, and I was just blown away. Like, how many people were there, all the great workshops. Like, it was just amazing to see everyone kind of convene in one place. And they have a lot of fun. You know, it's kind of like a county fair, a little bit atmosphere. You know, there's music.
And,
yeah, funky county fair. Yeah. But you could attend workshops on, you know, like designing your home for passive solar, or, you know, how to build your own wind turbine, and, you know, really advanced stuff. And they kind of rank them, you know, beginning and intermediate and advanced. And so it was just really inspiring, I think. And, you know, there's not a ton of environmental organizations in Milwaukee. I feel like a lot of them are headquartered in Madison. So it's great to have, you know, the MREA have an office here in Milwaukee, because there's so much potential for solar jobs. You know, we're a former manufacturing town, and the city and our sustainability office, I think, is really supportive of, you know, green jobs, and whether it's in energy efficiency or renewables. And so it's great to have Escuela Verde here and have them be a location where the MREA is, so people can come ask questions, and they teach their classes here. And now there's this, you know, demonstration location on the roof where people can get up here and look at the panels, and the students can take them off and put them back on. And
so what are you finding among your contemporaries? Are more people, is this starting to resonate with more people, or are you like so many of us in a bubble and you're not sure about the rest of the world?
Well, it's a huge cross section. I'm seeing a lot more interest in this technology and in this profession, because we're really poised for an explosion. I mean, in solar proliferation. I mean, it's to the tune of, what did Nick say? He compared it to our executive director, Nick Hyla, compared the rise of renewable energy right now, that we're kind of just at the tipping point of, to the actual like national electrification at the beginning of the 1900s. So there's just so much room for growth. I mean, right now we have solar leads in new electric generating capacity. So more solar is being added every year than hydro or wind or nuclear or natural gas or coal. More solar is being added than all of those. But that having been said, there's still In terms of our overall energy mix, solar only makes up a fraction of a percent of our overall energy mix in Wisconsin. In California, I think it's as high as 6%. In Vermont, it's like 2%. But here, it's a fraction of a percent. So we have so much room for growth. It's starting to become normalized. It's much more affordable. It's accessible for more and more people. So as far as a career goes, it's really ideal.
Yeah, and there's a nonprofit in Washington, D.C. called the Solar Foundation, and they do an annual solar job census. So they've been tracking the number of solar jobs over the past probably like 8 years. And from 2012 to 2017, the number solar employment grew 110%. So on average, about 16% per year. You know, and in the past, a lot of that was happening on the East Coast and the West Coast, but it's starting to make its way to the Midwest. So we have so much potential for jobs. And I feel like it's just kind of a great place to start, I feel like. It has everything. And it's nice to know that there's more jobs out there than just the installation jobs, which are really important. But, you know, there's jobs in finance, there's legal jobs, marketing, PR, project management, all of that.
Can I talk a little bit more about the energy fair? Is that okay?
But I think it's exciting, too, to see, like, the transformation. And I feel like Midwesterners are very, you know, practical and
conservative.
Yeah, but then they come to these. I think that's why it's so important to have these educational sessions. Like, people come, you know, and they've done a little bit of research on their own, but it's nice to have this, like, independent organization that they can ask questions to. They're not trying to sell them anything. They're just there to give them information. And I feel like people make the decision, like a lot of them, like on the spot, and they'll be like, okay, I'm ready to go. And you know, it's just exciting to see it all kind of happening now. It's exciting to be a part of it, I think.
Yeah, we just put in a gigantic solar carport, which prior to seeing it, it's like, do those exist? It makes so much sense, right? To charge electric vehicles under a big solar carport. It's like, it's so obvious. Like, there's our fuel. It comes from the sun. We don't need gasoline anymore. But seeing it makes something clicks in your mind when you see it actually in motion.
You know from your experience that there is momentum here in Wisconsin.
To give you an example, I'm just about to finish a program, about a 6-month long program, in Sauk County. It's called Solar Sauk County. And, you know, over 300 individuals have come to information sessions just to learn, just to find out what is this all about. A lot of them are going to be going solar as a result of the program. There's so much interest. It just makes sense. It makes financial sense. And now that we're at that point where it's more affordable, way more people are doing it, and it's just become, like I said, it's become more normal. It's easier to learn about. It's easier to invest in. There's plenty of solar installers in the market. So, you know, it's not dominated by one company or anything. A lot of local installers, local jobs. They can't be outsourced. It's positive all the way around.
Peter Murphy is the Milwaukee-based solar program manager with the Midwest Renewable Energy Association. Elizabeth Hittman serves on its board of directors, and by day she is sustainability program coordinator in the City of Milwaukee's Environmental Collaboration Office.
The 29th annual MREA Energy Fair starts tomorrow and runs through Sunday. They spoke with Susan Bentz, and there is more information at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break and then meet Anna Lardinoy, the 11th narrator in residence at the Pfister Hotel. You are listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. For the past decade, the Pfister Hotel has had both an artist and a narrator in residence. Each appointment lasts a year. The artists have a studio just off the lobby where visitors can chat with them and watch them create. The narrator has a desk on the first landing of the grand staircase leading from the main lobby.
The current and 11th narrator, Anna Lardinoy, began her tenure last month. We visited her at the hotel to find out more about the position and why she wanted the job.
This was honestly a dream of mine, and I'm so excited that it has finally come true. Ever since I learned about the Pfister narrator position, I have wanted to do this, but it never felt like the right time to apply. And this year just felt like the right year, and I'm very fortunate to be here. I wanted to be a part of this because I love the Pfister so much. So many wonderful things have happened to me in this building, and I just love the magic of it. But I also wanted to have the opportunity to connect other people with the hotel in lots of different ways. And I'm most known for giving tours, and wanted to incorporate that kind of connection in with the history of the Pfister.
When you think about the Pfister, or someone first comes in who might not know much about it, what are some of the first things that you want to tell them, that you want them to know about this building and this place?
Well, I think I first want them just to soak up the majesty of the lobby, because it is just so magnificent. It's almost like stepping into another more elegant world. And so I just want to show them and then let them know that this hotel has been continually operated since 1893. And much of the things that make this so magical and special are part of the original design, and I think that that's really wonderful.
Yeah, we're in the lobby right now. We are talking right now, and we are actually up on a landing because this is your desk.
It is.
And so for the year that you are the narrator, this is where you will mostly be?
That's correct. So when I'm in the hotel, I'll be at this desk unless I'm interviewing people or attending one of the events. And it's very exciting to be able to just look over the lobby in this wonderful, magnificent place and know that I am going to be a part of its history.
I'm not from here. I came here 12 years ago for the job, and somebody said, you must go to see the lobby of the Pfister. So I walked up here, because we're just, you know, a few blocks away, and I walked in and I looked at that ceiling and I thought, I feel like I'm in Europe.
I know. It's so wonderful. And then as you walk around, you see all this magnificent art, and it takes you to a special place. And then if that's not enough, the views are just astonishing. My very first day that I was here, the wonderful executive assistant of the hotel gave me a tour of the hotel. And one of the things that she showed me, just I knew that she understood me right away, is she took me to her favorite bathrooms in the hotel that had these absolutely magnificent views of the city that you're going to get nowhere else. And it just made me feel like this is the right place for me to be.
There's something about, it sounds funny to say, but there's something about a well-appointed bathroom. And I love the ones that take some care. It's not just a functional place. It's a place, why not have some aesthetic some views and some other things that make it just special to go into?
Well, the one that really struck me that she took me to not only had these amazing views, but it's on the seventh floor, and many brides use that bathroom as kind of their touchstone area for getting ready. And it seemed like a wonderful place just to relax with the book or just do anything lovely and self-pampering, because it was just such a nice bathroom.
Well, speaking of art, we are standing right in front of a piece. Who is this?
Well, this piece is titled Breakfast. It is part of the 3D virtual tour, and it is one of the many pieces that have been with the hotel since it opened. I am just doing this deep dive into all the history. This week I've been spending time looking at the very first convention that the Pfister ever held, which was just weeks after it was opened. And the newspaper covered it extensively because it's a brand new hotel, it's the first one. And I'm looking at all of the drawings, and that is actually when I first noticed that. And so I did a little research, and I'm like, oh yeah, this beautiful painting, which I have always loved and thought was original, not original to the hotel. So I'm just so excited to find out all this new stuff.
Now, does the Pfister have its own historical archives that you're able to access?
Well, I got the opportunity to meet the archivist. Her name is Leslie Hendricks. She is pretty much my favorite person I've met in this whole entire journey. We were just two peas in a pod initially, because we both whipped out our little steno pads, and then we knew that we had a kindred spirit, and we both get really excited about original source material. So, unfortunately, we haven't always appreciated keeping things for historical reasons. And it wasn't until the Marcus Corporation took this over that there even starts to be an archive. They do have things from the past, but it's not nearly as rich as one would hope it is with all the history that's happened here. But the Marcus Corporation is really committed to documenting the things that are happening and preserving them now. And she has painstakingly gone through and continues to go through thousands of images that were taken at the hotel and then tried to date and document them and create this database of information so that people can draw on and use it in the future.
Well, that to me, that would be a wonderful resource to have. Oh, anyone who's interested. Does the Milwaukee Historical Society have anything about the Pfister, or is it just sort of general?
Well, they do. I actually, when I was in the application process, when I found out I was a finalist, my very first stop was to the Milwaukee County Historical Society, because I've done so much work there in the past, and I feel so comfortable there. I knew that even if I didn't find a lot of great stuff, it would still be very comforting to be in that building because I love that library. So I went through their boxes, because how historical societies work is they just get whatever people donate to them. And then they archive it and then wait for someone to want it. So usually when you go to a historical society, you say, I want this subject. And then they give you a box and some files and then tell you to have at it. Right. So I wasn't sure what I would find. The thing that most sticks with me that I did find is they have a bunch of menus from the Charles Pfister era of very important events that happened here. When the Prussian royalty came, when some of the presidents came. So they have the menus of what was served that day. And it's just so fascinating to look at to see how our tastes have changed about what we think is fancy. Because it's pretty obvious just from looking at the menus without doing much research that turtle soup was considered incredibly elaborate and delicious and elegant because it appeared on almost all of those early menus.
All right, so let's get to the first thing you're going to show me here. Well, so we're up on this lobby area, and we're in front of a glass case.
Right, and so I just got done saying that we don't have a lot of things from the Pfister era, and now I'm going to show you some things from the Pfister era. So these are some of the physical pieces that are part of the archive, and I particularly really like looking at the keys and just imagining what that would be like, especially when you walk in what I call the historic part of the hotel, which is the floors 1 through 8, because that was the original. And I'm going to take you up to the third floor as well. And to me, that really gives you a sense of what this hotel must have been like. And I find it very exciting.
I always think, who touched those keys?
Right, right. Here's an example of one of the entry books, and I just look at these signatures and wonder, who are these people? Why were they here? Where did they go on to? I just really, really get excited about these things because I've been doing so much reading about it, its opening in research for the information about the first convention. They published extensively in the paper a list of how much everything cost. In $1893, a pair of wine glasses were listed at $250. So I put that into a historical conversion. That's $7,000. Can you even imagine being offered a glass of wine in a $7,000 goblet?
I'd be terrified. I'd be terrified that it would crack in my hand and then I would owe that money.
Even in today's prices, they were talking about the curtain. No curtain in the hotel could be had for less than $500 a pair in 1893. They had the finest linens in the whole entire world were brought here. It was just an amazing amount of luxury and decadence that I cannot imagine, but kind of I still feel here, even though I know we are not drinking out of $7,000 goblets.
Well, I'm not anyway. And I are probably
right,
not.
But I can still feel that way a little bit when I'm in the lobby and I hear that tinkling piano and I am sitting in that comfortable club chair enjoying myself. I can feel that still, and I love it. The original Pfister china is made by the Haviland Company, and it was made just for the Pfister. And the original bill for the opening week of all of the silverware and dishes and crockery was $25,000 in 1893 money. So they spared no expense to make this a palace for everyday people. And it really, truly still is.
What do you hope to do for people in this position? What is it that the hotel wants you to do? And then is there anything in addition that you want to do? Mm-hmm.
My pitch for the position was really coming from a historical background. So it's the 125th year, and I wanted to look at the contrast between the first year and the 125th year to see what's changed and what stayed the same. And I also wanted to invite people to enjoy the history with us. So I've already started creating our very first self-guided tour that begins and ends at the Pfister, that has guests go into the city to experience the rest of the city and then come back to the majesty of the Pfister. I think that when people engage in history and the stories, it becomes so much more real to them, and they have so much more affection for things. And I want to welcome other people into this Pfister history and Pfister experience so that they can love this too.
Anna Lardinoy is the current Pfister narrator in residence. You can find her at her desk on the first stair landing off the main lobby. You can find out more about both Pfister residency programs at WUWM.com. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Listening. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.